Session number 10763, Reel 1.
Wing Commander Lucas, Reel 1. Can we start off by your telling me, please, how you came to be in flying in the Air Force?
I think, really, it started when I was at Cambridge as an undergraduate. I wasn't a member of the Air Squadron, but I used to go out to Duxford because I had friends in the Air Squadron and see them and enjoy the sort of parties and the mess and so on. And I thought all that was very agreeable. And because I happened to be a golfer, I got to know, really very well, Philip Sassoon, who was then, or part of the time at any rate, the Under Secretary of State for Air in the sort of period just before the war, just before Harold Balfour. And he had various houses, and he had one house in North London, Trent Park, where he had a private golf course. And when the Americans came over here, and I played golf against America, he used to ask me and two or three friends and so on to go and play. And he always used to send his aeroplane up to Duxford to fly us down. I and another undergraduate friend of mine who was a good player and played for Britain and that. And I was very much taken with this, and so when I didn't think anything more of it about joining the VR or Auxiliary Air Force or anything like that, on September the 3rd, when the announcement was made of war, I was sitting with my mother, it was a Sunday, in our drawing room at home, a house in Hertfordshire, and I heard Chamberlain's broadcast, and she said to me, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to join the Air Force." And I never gave it another thought. I never thought I'd go and join the Royal Navy or the Army or anything. I just thought I'd join the Royal Air Force. And it was that sort of background, I think, which started it. And I could see that she was absolutely alarmed beyond measure.
When you heard the announcement that we were at war with Germany, what was your reaction?
I was a journalist working for Lord Beaverbrook at the time, and I had been for about nearly four years since I came down from the university, and I'd heard all this talk. Mark you, Beaverbrook always had a banner headline on the Daily Express every day, "There will be no war this year or next year either." And in the office, the view was very different. I mean, they had a lot of very good foreign correspondents, Sefton Delmer and a few others, who were always talking about their experiences and what was going on in Germany, and that insofar as they knew, and they were pretty well informed. And I don't think that we probably thought there was going to be peace for very much longer and that war would come. And so I don't think it was any great surprise to me. I can remember very well on the Saturday night, I was working on the Sunday Express at the time, and I was very lucky because I was very young. I was a sports columnist on the Sunday Express. And I can remember doing my column, and the editor, John Gordon, who was a first-class editor by any standards, and he'd been the editor of the paper and continued to be for many years. And I can remember him just looking at my stuff, and I had it in the typewriter, I was knocking it off, and he said, "What's the good of doing that?" He said, "There'll be a war." And I said, "Well, come to think of it, I suppose there will be. But I must tell you that I didn't, like some of my contemporaries, I wasn't always thinking about what was going to happen if there was a war, or what I was going to do, or anything of the sort. It was just a sort of natural metamorphosis, really, of the events of those times. It's a very curious feeling. I mean, it sounds tremendously unpatriotic and impracticable and all that, but I really didn't. I went on doing my work in the paper. I was very happy doing it and was sent around the world and so on by Beaverbrook. And I just thought, well, a bit of a fatalist, really, I suppose, with this. And if it happened, well, it was going to happen. That was all. I mean, my entry was very undramatic because I was an amateur. I mean, I went into the Air Force at the beginning. I came out at the end because I didn't go back to Fleet Street afterwards, but I wanted to get back to civilian life and get married and make some money if I could. And so I was an absolutely typical amateur in the Royal Air Force. On the 4th of September, on the Monday, I went to recruiting office, wherever it was, and joined up. And we went, I remember, to Uxbridge. And then, after a time, we were sent home again because there weren't any aeroplanes to fly. Nor could I see the least prospect when I started, about 8 months later, in June of 1940, the least prospect of being able to learn to fly, because no training aeroplanes really were speaking of. And I was at that initial training wing in Cambridge and enjoyed it very much. I mean, I remember we went from Uxbridge to Cambridge on the train, and we got out at the station in Cambridge, which I knew very well from my undergraduate days, and instead of getting a taxi to take one to the college, we were lined up in three rows and marched straight down the station road and into Trumpington Street and down towards King's Parade, and we were halted outside my old college, Pembroke. And I was in my usual place in the middle of the back row, and we were stood at ease, and one or two were supposed to go off and be billeted in Pembroke, and I suddenly saw the the old head porter, Tom, with his red walrus moustache hanging down, his top hat and his tail coat, and he'd obviously seen a few more coming by like that, and he'd see if he could recognise any faces, and he suddenly saw mine. And I saw him throw his head back, his top hat nearly came off with laughter, and he said, "Oh dear," he said, and he just waggled his finger. And I thought, well, I do hope I'm going there, but unfortunately we were then moved on, and we went to St. John's. But the thing was that I was an absolute amateur. I had no flying experience before, excepting just a little bit in America when I'd been goffing there and used to fly from place to place. But apart from that, I had none.
Just going back to something you said about Sefton Delma, what kind of a chap was he?
Oh, he was a first-class journalist, and he had tremendous courage, Sefton, because he was quite prepared to... Mark you, he could speak languages, of course, which helped him very much. And he always seemed to me to be particularly well-informed, and I can remember Chris Christensen, the editor of the Daily Express, who was a sort of idol of mine, a hero, just as Gordon was, for that matter. I mean, they were two absolutely first-class editors. Beaverbrook had made Chris the editor of the Daily Express when he was 29, you know, and he'd got that beat on the crash of the R-101 at Beauvais. He was working on the Sunday Express. I think he was the assistant editor of the Sunday Express at the time, and he changed the whole of the front page off his own bat and got, I think, 8,000 or 10,000 copies out on the streets for the morning and beat the world with the story. And anyway, I can always remember Chris saying, "Now, if you want to see a good foreign journalist, you just read that stuff of Sefton's," he said, "it's first class." And I think that, and what I knew of him, and you must understand that I was a very humble bod then. I was, say, 22 or 3 or whatever it was. And although Beaverbrook gave great responsibility to the young, he was, the great thing about him, about Beaverbrook, was that he always wanted the young to be given a chance. The Express newspapers in those days were a very young group, rather like the Royal Air Force was afterwards. I mean, group captains at 23, 24, looking after God knows how many people, and they did it very well, and Beaverbrook took this view, and so he let the young have their head, and he was very good to me personally. My father had died when I was very young, 11 I think, and he knew that, and he took a sort of fatherly interest. I don't say he wasn't a critic. He saw one stuff and said, "I don't know why you write about that ridiculous stuff," or something, or else he'd ring you up and say, "Well, it's a good story, I read it today, and I thought that was good, you put it together well, good first paragraph." He was rather like Murdoch, you see. He was a journalist, not like these bumped up guys who buy newspapers who don't know anything, first thing about journalism. Must be very difficult for the editors. Mark, it was pretty difficult for the editors with Beaverbrook because he was so interested all the time. But there were, on the Express in those days, a number of really first-class journalists. I mean, Alan Moorhead, who was the war correspondent. I mean, there were two really outstanding war correspondents. Well, several, obviously. But, I mean, Alan Moorhead was, and Alexander Clifford on the Mail. These were two really first-class journalists, and like on the American side, it was Quint Reynolds and Ed Murrow and Ernie Pyle and so on. And I was always fascinated by these people and how well they did things. But Sefton Delma was exceptional as a foreign correspondent because he was so well-informed.
Did his hatred of the Nazi regime come out?
Very much. He knew what was going on. He had rather, in a way, and it's not an unreasonable analogy, I don't think, rather in a way that Chapman Pincher has got into all this MI5 and all this spy stuff. And I always got the impression that Sefton really sort of got in among the Nazi party and really knew what was going on. He played it along because he had these very good contacts in Germany. And I think that the stories which came out of the Express, mark you, I mean, they didn't really square with Beaverbrook's claim that there'll be no war this year or next year either, in fact. But then they didn't mind that on the Express. I mean, they gave journalists a free run. And irrespective of the policy of the paper, the policy of the paper came out in the opinion column. But what the leader writers or the feature writers may have said was another thing. And that was one of it was a bit like a squadron, actually, the Daily Express. I mean, and I had this stories jumping on now, but I mean, when I was in Malta in 1942, in the middle of the battle, I used to see the Daily Express. I sent one the other day, funnily enough, with its four pages. That was all that there was in the wartime. There was no newsprint worth speaking of. And I used to read the stuff in the Daily Express about what was going on in Malta, and it was rubbish. And it used to make me furious. And I can remember saying to the station commander, Jumbo Gracie, at Takali once, I said, you know, I mean, it's all very well putting out this propaganda, but a lot of this stuff is absolute rubbish. Well, you know, we got to the point in Malta in April 1942, which was the nadir of our fortunes, when we were, or they could have taken Malta if they'd really made a try at it. We then were flying these Spitfires in off the carriers, and we had some disasters with that, mainly because they were sending pilots out who really weren't particularly well trained. If two pilots were asked to be sent out from a squadron, well, they'd send the people they didn't want. Naturally, if you were a squadron commander and wanted to get rid of a couple of guys, send them out to Malta, you know. And so it was very rough on the people who were out there and surviving. But anyway, when the American aircraft carrier Wasp was brought into play, which turned the battle in the middle of May, in the 9th and 10th of May, for about 10 days, it did two runs, and this was fixed up by Churchill with Roosevelt, special concession, could take 48 Spitfires, whereas the Eagle, for instance, could only take 16. And the first run, I mean, it went off very well, but within 48 hours, of the 47 aircraft, there was one which didn't go. It was flown by an American who just beat it to North Africa. He didn't fancy it. And so as soon as they took off from Algiers, they took off from a point about 60 miles north of Algiers, which was about 650 miles from the island. You couldn't get any closer. The Mediterranean fleet wouldn't allow it. I mean, the commander-in-chief said, that's quite close enough. You fly off from here with these 90-gallon tanks on, which we did, and it was a fairly rough assignment. We're doing our own navigation and all that. And when this first 48 were flown off the Wasp, loaded up in Glasgow and just sent straight through the straits, after 48 hours, of course, the Germans had been monitoring this all the way, and these raids came in one after another, and of course they beat these aeroplanes up on the ground, and I think there were seven serviceable after 48 hours. I mean, it was an absolute tragedy, that. Well, anyway, of course, all this stuff was made light of. Well, then in the papers, and then the Wasp did a second run. I think it took Churchill great persuasion with Roosevelt to let it do a second run, in point of fact. And it met up with the Eagle, and the two of them together. Eagle flew off 16, and the Wasp flew off 48. 64 aeroplanes. I don't think all 64 got in, but very close to it. And this, of course, actually turned the battle. Well, at that time, when the second run of the Wasp was taking place, the AOC of Malta, Hugh Pugh Lloyd, who was a marvellous chap, a real buccaneer. I mean, he was the original hijacker. He used to collar these blooming aeroplanes going on to the Middle East, you know, and they were supposed to be going in. I mean, he said, well, if we're going to fly these aeroplanes in again, we've got to send some leaders back to Gibraltar. And so quite a number of us went back and led these aeroplanes in off the carriers. And I can remember in the station, the Royal Air Force station at Gibraltar, going into the orderly room and seeing a typewriter without a cover on it. And I thought, and I could see a few pilots in the mess who were ferrying aeroplanes out and then coming back to England and then taking more out. And I knew one or two of them. And I thought to myself, well, here's a chance. I'll just, because the censorship in Malta, I mean, you couldn't get anything out. And I thought, well, I just wound a couple of sheets of paper into the typewriter, and I knocked off about 1,500, a couple of thousand words, you know, whatever it was, a couple of hours or something. And I gave this account with a covering letter to a friend of mine who was very close to Beaverbrook. I didn't think I could address this to Lord Beaverbrook, or quite right. And I said to this chap, would you post this for me when you get into England with an English stamp on it? So, question of censorship. Oh, yeah, I'll do that. Well, I never thought anything more of it until one day, about, oh, I should think 3 weeks later, fortnight or 3 weeks later, I saw the AOC, Hugh Pulloy, and he said, why do you write to the newspapers? And I said, sir, I don't write to the newspapers. I mean, I know I'm not allowed to communicate with the press. Well, he said, there's a good story of yours, he said, on the front page of the Daily Express. And I said, well, and he showed me the paper. And it wasn't signed, but of course he knew who it was, because it, the Chris Christensen, who was the editor and I knew well, had on a, all the way down page one, on the front page, single corner, and it, the head on it was A Knight of Malta Writes Home. And here was this thing, and of course when I looked at it, he said, well, it's a good story, isn't it? But you know you're not allowed to do that. And he was awfully nice about it. And then about another, oh, I suppose 10 days later, in a envelope, a copy of the Express was contained, and there was a little note on it, circled right at the top in that sort of black subbing pencil that we used to use in the Express in those days, if you're subbing on the desk, and it simply had, so you finally made page one, exclamation mark, C. Well, that was Christensen doing this thing. And so anyway, I mean, I didn't dare write a letter or anything thanking him or getting on the front page. Well, I heard nothing more. And Lloyd forgot all about it. Group captain said something to me about, oh, you journalists, you're all the same, you know, and all that. Then about, oh, I should think a fortnight later, or 3 weeks later, I had a letter from a chap called E.J. Robertson, Robbie, who was effectively the managing director of the Express newspapers. He was, I think, actually called the general manager. I don't think Beaverbrook had any managing directors in those days, didn't before the war. And he was a Canadian. He was he'd been a bellhop in a hotel in Toronto, and Beaverbrook had taken to him, and he'd brought him over here, and he'd risen right to the top, and he was a person of quite exceptional caliber, and I'd had, just as a young journalist, young man, had several dealings with him. And anyway, here was this letter, and it simply said, dear laddie, Lord Beaverbrook is thrilled by the exploits of your squadron. Here's a cheque for £50. He thinks it might come in useful just now. Signed, yours sincerely, Robbie. And I thought, well, damn it, well, anyhow, we had a tremendous party and piss up in the mess and all that sort of thing. And I didn't think of it. I wrote back to him and I said, thank you very much for it. I gratefully received and lighted up. And then about another fortnight later, I got another letter from him saying, dear laddie, Lord Beaverbrook, as I told you, is thrilled by the exploits of your squadron, number 249. But he thinks that we haven't sent you enough. So here's another cheque for £50. And so that was it. That was £100. And anyway, whether that was for services rendered to my story on page one, which I never intended anyone, all I intended it to be was background for the Express, for the editors to know what was actually going on. And he hadn't submitted it to the censor, and I believe there was a most terrible row about it, actually. But anyhow, I didn't hear any more. I suppose they thought, well, the chap's doing his stuff, we don't want to upset him or something. But that was really the way it was. But anyway, I mean, that all arises out of Sefton Delma and so on. But the Express, it was a marvel. And of course, they were, the Express and Beaverbrook were absolutely flat out for the Royal Air Force, because Max Aitken, Beaverbrook's son, who was a friend of mine, he'd been an auxiliary in the Auxiliary Air Force since, oh, I should think, 36 or 37. I know he always used to say to me, why don't you join the Auxiliary Air Force? But I had no feeling that I wanted to before the war. I'm not a belligerent sort of guy. I didn't feel particularly that sort of way. But when the war came, one just did it. But I was an amateur. That's my point.
Now, when you first got to Malta, what was the situation that you found there? Did it surprise you?
Oh, absolutely, because we had been told, I had been in 66 Squadron. That was my first squadron. I'd been trained in Canada. I went to 66 down in Cornwall, at Port Reith, in 10 Group, and it was very boring stuff flying round convoys, round Land's End and Plymouth and all the way around there. Very seldom saw any aeroplanes and so on. Just occasionally we used to go on these sorties to Brest, where the Scharnhorst and the Eugen and the Neisenau were either there or soon to be there. And after about, oh, I don't know, 6 or 8 months of this, I and another friend of mine, great friend of mine, called Raoul Dado Longley, whose father had been in the Royal Air Force before, was a flying boat captain and all that before the war, a most exceptional pilot. And we'd trained together in Canada and we had flown together a lot. And a posting came through for two pilots to volunteer for Burma. And so Ra said to me, why don't we put in for it? We can't have any more of this. This is boring. And so we said, all right, we put in for it. Well, then, about a fortnight later, we were in Malta, not Burma at all. And when we were told before we went there that the Spitfires, I mean, we'd been flying Spitfires in 66, that the Spitfires would be there, and we were the sort of spearhead of the Spitfire pilots who were to go out and fly them. And I can remember it very well, because we all had to foregather in Plymouth on Friday the 13th. Of February. I can remember the date because Friday the 13th had a significance for me, not because it was I was superstitious necessarily about it, but because it turned out for me to be a very lucky date. And we all foregathered in a hotel in Plymouth, and we were going to be flown out the next day in a Sunderland flying boat. And the leader, the sort of bellwether of our flock, was a Canadian called Stan Turner, he became group captain. Stanley Percival Turner, he died last year, the year before. Excellent man. And he'd been in the Battle of France in 242 Squadron when they had that terrible collapse with an appalling squadron commander, and awful stories he used to tell about what went on in France. And then he'd been with Baader in the Battle of Britain. I remember him telling me once, incidentally, he said we'd had this appalling French-Canadian squadron commander in 242 in the Battle of France, and we'd been rather badly let down. And he said we'd all been sent to Coltishall with the squadron. And then suddenly, he said, a fellow with no legs was sent to look after us. And this was Baader, he said. And I thought to myself, oh, Christ, we had one fellow in France, and now we've got a guy without any legs. But of course they became devoted, and he realized very soon that Douglas was quite exceptional. Douglas and I married sisters. And so anyway, old Stan in this hotel in Plymouth, it was in February, and so I had a great coat on, and I can remember walking in to the lounge, and Stan was there, the squadron leader, DFC, I think Anne Barr. And I said, good evening, sir. And he didn't say good evening. He just opened my greatcoat and looked at my wings to see if I'd got a decoration. And as I hadn't, I'd got nothing. I mean, I'd flown about 350 hours. I mean, I'd done nothing He just simply shut it up, you know, and I should say, well, there's another of them, you know. But anyhow, we flew out to Malta, and we stopped in Gibraltar for a night, and then we went down the Mediterranean through the night, you know, and masses of electric storms, I remember, bouncing about low down, of course, under the radar cover. And we landed in Califrana Bay just as dawn was breaking. And as we got out of the Sunderland, out onto the jetty, the air raid sirens started to wail, which was sort of par for the course in Malta, you know, they were at the whole time. And suddenly one heard the throb of sort of Rolls-Royce engines, Merlin engines, and they sounded very rough, I may say. And here were five clapped out Hurricane 2s in an old-fashioned Vic formation, which they had given up in the Battle of Britain, just beginning to clamber up to gain height. And then about, oh, I suppose nothing more than about a minute or a couple of minutes later, high up, and you could just see it as the dawn was breaking in the haze, a lovely spring morning, February. There were these about probably a Staffel, I suppose, of 109s flying in that beautiful wide open line abreast formation that they used to fly their Schwarms in. The two aircraft was the sort of basis of their flying, but then they used to put them together in fours, and they were flying high and fast. And Earl Stan, I can see him now with his pipe turned down. He had a pipe always, but he never, very seldom had anything in it. And he had it turned down, and he just looked up at these things, and he said, "Good God!" And then turned on his heel and headed towards the mess where we had breakfast. I mean, he could hardly believe it. Now, we had, and as I, in reflection, in hindsight, and so on, it was a great experience, actually, to fly those old Hurricanes before the Spitfires arrived, because I was flying with Stan. And, I mean, it made one realise what those Hurricane pilots had been enduring against the Messerschmitt 109F. I mean, in France, the Spitfire 5 and the Messerschmitt 109F were very evenly matched, and on the whole, many will no doubt have told you. I mean, I think that those of us who were in the Spitfire 5s, etc., thought that we were probably, we'd got the edge on the 109. It was when the 190 appeared, and against all, that was an absolute murder. Anyway, here, I mean, these Hurricane 2s and getting all clapped out, and they've been cannibalised, you know, in order to be able to keep just a handful going. They were flying against these 109Fs, and by God, fellas, I mean, what those fellas must have done for a period of about 5 or 6 months, I just really hate to think, because we had a fortnight of it. Now, in that time, and Stan Turner then, I mean, he was the architect of the change in the flying in Malta, and he's never really been given the credit for it. Oh, Stan, he was a... He was